So it's good to be here again. Like Jill said, I've been here a couple times, and I always enjoy my time with the community here. You guys have a wonderful community. And let's see, I think we'll meditate, but if you want, I can introduce myself a little bit if you
want. However you like to do it.
Whatever works.
I prefer to bore people more towards the end of the talk than at the beginning of it, but we'll see. So yeah, I've been a monk for maybe 8 years, and you want to know how I kind of came to it?
Yeah.
I'll give you the short version. I was a music student at Berklee College of Music in Boston. It's a music school there, not UC Berklee. And just like all of you, at some point I became interested in meditation and started having access to different Eastern spirituality. First, Yogananda was like sort of, you know, I was really into Yogananda, and that thing, Autobiography of a Yogi, really hit home with me. I recently was in LA, and I got to, I was teaching at Insight LA, and I got to go to, there's a Shrine Lake that their organization has, and Yogananda spent a lot of time there, so it was kind of nice to be where he meditated a lot. Then I eventually, checking out different traditions, I eventually found Tibetan Buddhism and found a teacher in that and just continued that path. And I wanted to become a monk. I just had this sort of wish. There wasn't really any kind of a lot of thought around it, just a feeling to want to do it. And then it took me about 7 years to turn that feeling into an actual actuality. So I think I would, you want to know more maybe the emotional process or maybe that. I think in our culture, it's, we don't have a lot of time normally, like a lot of us. Maybe in Santa Cruz, some of you have more than others, I don't know. Maybe less. Our culture has become quite busy. And so really it just was, wow, I find this lifestyle valuable. I think, being a monk will offer me the time to dive deeper into my personal meditation practice and study. Also, with the support of the vows, it offers a support for the practice as well. So really, it was just that. And then kind of, checking out over the years, and then until I was 28, I'm 30, I think I'm 36 now. So it's kind of like that. But I think, the monastic path, it's not so, what's the word? Like, we're still like, monastics are still the same as everyone else. Actually, I tell people, we're more than beginners because we need, more. You know what I mean? Like, we need more rules, to work with our minds. So almost that's how it felt to me. And so I was like, okay, I want to do this. So it's not like that, what's the word? It's quite special, I think, as a path. Not I'm special, but the path of it, I think, is special, and I wish everyone can have the opportunity to do that. I love how in Theravada Buddhism, most people, I would say men, I guess, get a chance to be monks at least at some point in their life. And I'm sure now there's more opportunities for women to become nuns as well, for at least, 6 months, 3 months, maybe a year. That's a wonderful tradition. I wish we had that in Tibetan Buddhism. Yeah. But what I was trying to get to was, it's sort of an experience that you still have to work with your mind. And so, being a, I was in a punk bands and all kinds of music, and so I had a lot of stuff to work with coming to the monastic path. And I still do, as you'll find out tonight as I talk. So, yeah, I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's kind of the background a little bit. So I think let's practice for 30 minutes, and then we'll go into tonight's talk. Yeah, does that sound good?
Yeah.
Is there anyone actually here who's never meditated before? I assume there's not, but it's okay if you haven't. No? Okay. Then I'm not going to really give much instruction. I'll just do it. Okay. So I'm going to recite a few prayers. What do we normally do in my tradition before the teachings? So if you're a Buddhist practitioner, you can take refuge along with me. Just feel in your heart refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And generate loving kindness, compassion. And I'll walk us through that a little bit too. Yeah. So you could just think that while I'm reciting, yeah? Sangye chodan soge chonam la jangju barandu dani kyabsa chi Dage jin soge pe sonam ki drala penjir sangye drubar sho Sangye chodan soge chonam la jangju barandu dani kyabsa chi Dāgī jīnsoi gīpē sōnāṁ kī drūlā pēnshīr sāngyē drūpār shūk. Sāngyē chūdāṁ sōgī chūnāṁ lā jāngchū bārdū dāgī kyabsū chī. Dāgī jīnsoi gīpē sōnāṁ kī drūlā pēnshīr sāngyē drūpār shūk. Ongargi yugi nocha sampema gesara nubo la yamsen chagi ngadrani Pema juni shesu changkodu kandra mampo kwa Kegi jesu da jagi jingi labje shesu su Guru pema siddhi Ongargi yugi nocha sam Pema gesara dombo la yamsen chaki ngadrani Pema juni shesu cha kordu kandra mampo kur Kegi jesu dadraki chenje lamchir shesu so Guru pema siddhi hun orgi yugi no cha sam Pema gesara dumbo la yamsen shaki ngadrani Pema juni shesu cha kordu kandru mampu kur Kegi jisu dadraki Jinja labjir shesu so guru pema siddhi hum So in your heart just generate the motivation of loving kindness and compassion, that just as all sentient beings wish happiness and wish to avoid suffering, just as ourselves wish to have happiness and wish to avoid suffering, so do all sentient beings. And since we're here tonight discussing, meditating, and reflecting on the profound Buddha Dharma, which becomes a direct cause to liberate ourselves from suffering, we just generate a gentle motivation that this may this also become a cause that we may benefit and help all others to liberate themselves also from suffering and its causes. So just generate that in your heart based on loving kindness and compassion. Then in order to create the cause of an open mind to receive the teaching without bias and in the spirit of non-judgment, if you're a Buddhist practitioner, you can visualize the Buddha in front of you. If you're not, just visualize something or imagine something that is a source of refuge to you. This could also be something, could be light if you want, something that represents enlightened wisdom. And we're going to imagine offering whatever we find beautiful. Maybe it's something you saw in your day-to-day, a beautiful flower, an image, something kind, maybe a beautiful meal you had. And then we'll multiply this image, infinitely filling the sky. And we're going to offer it to
whatever we're objectifying as representation of enlightened wisdom, we're going to offer it up without any attachment. Joyful to give it and offer it as a cause for us to cultivate non-judgment, openness, discernment, and awareness. And imagine that that form of enlightened wisdom completely accepts it without any reservations. Tonight's talk, I titled Going Beyond Dogma, and it's admittedly, it's a bit of a trick to get you here, so I was successful with some of you. Maybe you were already going to come anyways. So why I call it a bit of a trick, and of course I'm joking, I really was not trying to trick you, but why I call it a bit of a trick is, obviously, I'm going to talk about dogma because I'm a Buddhist practitioner. And whenever we have something where we have a religious idea or ideology and we're approaching that, there's going to be from a traditional literal definition of dogma, you can't really avoid it to a certain extent. So the word dogma itself has become kind of a dirty word in our culture. But when I actually looked up the definition, it's not that dirty. It's a little stinky, but not that dirty. So, because I have a really awkward relationship with the word dogma, you know? We put so much on it, but when you actually Wikipedia it, it's not that bad. But anyways, that's why I'm saying what I'm saying. So based off the literal definition, which I'll recite in a second, we can't avoid it to a certain extent, because when we talk about Buddha Dharma, we're talking about, the Buddha's own realization, but that became systematized, right? So I just want to throw that out there so we're on the same sort of page. But with that said, we're going to break the word dogma out a little bit into a broader definition tonight. So go with me here, hopefully. Or I invite you to go with me. Why I want to bring it into a broader sort of definition is more for us as practitioners and how we can relate to our minds, our emotions, our feelings, and our practice. And so here, in a way, even if, let's say, we assume the Buddhist teachings do not have any dogma in them, let's just assume that for a second, you know? Even with that said, we still have to use language here tonight, and we still have to use our thinking mind to sort of understand and reflect together and discuss together. So automatically, there's a subject and object. So automatically, there's some kind of truth happening, right? So I'm expanding the term dogma here to also include when we fixate, or we cling, or we judge, yeah? So, not saying you're judging, but with language itself, because of its dualistic characteristics, it has kind of a smell of, like a whiff of dogma. You see what I'm saying? So we're going to explore this a little bit. So I just wanted to say that up front. So we're going to talk about going beyond dogma, but we have to use dogma to talk about going beyond dogma. It's kind of a weird thing, yeah? And actually, I find this to be one of the richer aspects of the Buddhist teachings. We're always using the relative as an example to refer to the ultimate, you know, in Buddhism. But, and the relative obviously is not the ultimate, you know? When I say the word enlightenment, it's not enlightenment. It's just the word enlightenment. But we have to use these terms to sort of gain some kind of idea and experience to then practice to have that direct experience, which is not dogmatic, correct? So it's a really interesting thing. And actually, in the Buddha Dharma, we don't generally, especially in the Mahayana canon, generally we don't have a problem with this. Like, when the Buddha gave what we call like his lion's roar of Dharma, where he taught what we call the middle way teachings, so the Prajnaparamita teachings, when the Buddha taught this, it was again working with this aspect of not the same but not different, not one but not many, also not relative but not ultimate. So ultimately, we have to come to an understanding of how these unify. This is very, very difficult. And so I'm not going to go so much into that tonight. I just wanted to point that out. Because whenever we're referencing these things, we always have this rub where when we light a stick of incense for offering it, we can analyze that through Vipassana meditation. And we can come to a place where we see its impermanent nature. And you actually can't, after a while, as you practice these things, you can't find an incense stick. It's still there. You can hold it in your hand. You can smell it. You can offer it. But you can't find it. But we can take so much care in the ritual of offering that incense stick. We can embody what that offering means as we're offering it to the Buddha, for instance, or whatever we're offering it to. And as Buddhists, we don't actually have a problem with that seemingly paradox. Yeah? This paradox of there not actually really being a truly existent incense stick, but yet we can take our time and form a beautiful ritual for offering that. Yeah? So again, that's where I'm coming from with this talk on going beyond dogma. Complex? Too much? So, apparently Wikipedia says dogma is a principle or set of principles laid down by an authority as incontrovertibly true. Yeah? So we have these two aspects of authority and then incontrovertibly true. Yeah? It goes on, but I'm just going to use the first part of that definition. I'm sure we can find other definitions if we Google around, yeah? But we'll just use that one for now. So, again, when we talk about dogma in reference to Buddha Dharma, because first I think we have to come to the same page together, yeah? And then we can sort of dive deeper in. So, I'd like to talk a little bit about like why Buddhism is dogmatic and why it isn't. Yeah? So obviously a lot of you are practitioners for a long time, so you might know why. We have teachings that come down from authority figures, you know. When the Buddha had reached enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he had a realization and experience to share with others, and he put it into words, which the others didn't have that experience necessarily. So they had to take his authority and then the practices he taught on faith and belief. Yeah. So again, I'm using this definition of dogma from here, not our extremely stinky one from the West. You know, we're dogma. Ooh, I don't want dogma. You know, this literal term of just something coming down from an authority figure is incontrovertibly true. It's a literal Wikipedia one. So, so this is why we have dogma in Buddhism, because we have systems that were then created, practices, ways of philosophy, ways of sort of doing things, right? Yeah? Do you agree? Yeah? So then why it isn't? So that's why Buddhism can be dogmatic. So then why ultimately does it not have dogma? Because ultimately what the teachings are alluding to is to go beyond the practices themselves, beyond the sort of thinking mind of just having a conceptual idea of these things, going to the direct experience, yeah? So this is what we call certainty, yeah, to a certain extent in Buddhism, where we can gain intellectual certainty through studying philosophy, through analyzing, reading sutras, analyzing the Buddha's words, etc., practice. But ultimately, we are trying to get to a direct experience. So this is where Buddhism is not dogmatic, because ultimately, once we get to a direct experience, no one has to tell you that's right or wrong. You know. There's a famous saying in Tibetan Buddhism where we say, when you gain full realization, even if the Buddha appears to you in person and says, that's not it, you don't have it, you know, you got to go back to your cave. You know, even if the Buddha does that, you can look the Buddha straight in the face and say, no, I've got it, you know, because you know, you have the certainty within your practice, again, over time, right, and effort. So I would say this is a good reason why Buddhism doesn't have dogma. Also, we're encouraged to investigate, to dig deeper, to, you know, like this famous quote by the Buddha, treat my teachings like you'd rub, you know, check gold to see if it's real. So, you know, apparently you'd sort of rub it, maybe with other stones, rub it with certain things, burn it, do different things, to see if it's fool's gold or real gold. So the Buddha said, you know, it's kind of a ignorant or foolish person who just hears my teachings and then takes it on dogma, meaning that just I'm an authority and then believes it. It's an intelligent or wise person who takes it and analyzes it to see, is this correct? Yeah? So, we also have these processes of, I don't know how much philosophy you guys study here, but I'm not going to go too deep into it, but we have these, a whole classification of teachings called pramana, in Buddhism in Sanskrit. And pramana refers to valid cognition, or I like another translation, which is correct knowledge. Yeah, that's another translation you can use. So this is the whole study of logic and how to have what we call a valid cognition, what that is, or a knowledge that is correct. So already you can smell the dogma, right? Correct, valid, right? You can smell it, yeah? But this process of working with valid cognition, and I'll explain what those are. There's three aspects normally. You can add a fourth. This process of working with valid cognition and gaining a valid cognition about a certain perception or meditation or a philosophical topic, the process itself is a dogmatic process that then brings you again to a non-dogmatic experience. Yeah? So always it's like this. I mean, I actually encourage you to think about, maybe reflect as I'm talking, is there anything in our life that's not like this? Meaning, like, we have to approach something. We have to learn about something. We hear, like, from someone else, oh, yeah, this guy Bernie sounds pretty good. I mean, you know, seems to get a lot of Facebook likes and like what he's saying, you know. So we have to hear from, we hear it first, and we sort of get evidence, and then we have an inference, and then we get a direct experience, you know. We can see him ourselves or hear him ourselves. All that kind of thing, right? So, I don't think there's a process. So we can discuss this. I mean, I'm kind of like asking you too. Yeah, like think about it. Is there a process in our life that where we don't have to approach something from first, like an inference, you know, and then we can use that inference to go into a direct experience, whether it's through our perception or something else. Yeah. I could say, like, one thing that's not, where our sense perceptions are not like that, right? Because you can see a flower and know the flower. You don't have to think, is this a flower? Eventually we label it, and then we know this is a rose, this is a, you know, daisy, different kinds of flowers. So other than that, I would say there's not a lot of our experience where we don't have to approach things from a viewpoint of fixation. So, these three types of valid cognition in Buddhism are, I already named two of them, inferential, you know, cognition. So in inferring, you know, for instance, an inference, a famous one in Buddhism is, if you see smoke, you know, there's probably fire, right? That's an inference. And then we have direct experience. So obviously that's the one we prefer. And then we have different kinds of direct experience, which I'm not going to go into. But for instance, like our sense perception is a form of direct experience. But then we have what's called yogic direct perceptions, which are more in meditation that start to happen over time, where you have a direct experience of impermanence, something like that. Yeah, you don't have to think about it; it just comes. And then the third is for first kind of more for once someone has entered the Buddhist path and they've accepted the Buddhist teachings, the third is scriptural authority. So again, that one is the stinkiest Dhamma one. So it has this, where we have interpretive sutras and definitive sutras. Or there's another word I like instead of that. Provisional and definitive. Yeah. So the definitive aspects of the sutras, then we can take as valid cognition once we accept those teachings as that, as a Buddhist practitioner. So I'm not really going to talk about those two that much. But I just wanted to bring that up. So we're using these valid cognitions as a way, as a dogma, to then get through dogma. Yeah? So a lot of things are like this. So I was thinking about it today, and I thought it's like dogma eats the dogma, you know, eventually. So that's kind of what we're trying to do. And again, bringing it to subtler levels, I introduced it a little bit at the beginning of tonight. But ultimately, we are trying to consume conceptual thought with conceptual thought. Or consume concept and dualistic experience through meditation itself. Yeah? So, but we have no choice. We have to use the means we have. We still have a thinking mind. We have a dualistic mind. So we have to use the tools from that to engage that to then penetrate into a non-dualistic experience. And essentially, this is what the Buddha found after meditating, yeah, for a long period of time. So, so ultimately, going back to this term certainty, certainty comes from this direct experience or this direct valid cognition. Once that happens for us, we have certainty. Like I said, you know, the Buddha can come right in front of you and say, you know, you don't have it, and you can, and you know you do. You know, so it's not an arrogance. It's a little, it's different than that. So then expanding a little bit, and this is mainly what I wanted to focus on tonight, is, you know, and again, I'm going to give some definitions, and I'm not saying these are definitive for you, so you can explore them. I encourage you two to come up with your own, because we're going to expand this term dogma into fixation and rigidity, and ultimately we're going to talk about judgment, and that's mostly what we're going to focus on. So I invite you to think about these. So when the mind is left unexamined, are we experiencing this kind of rigidity around something? Is it when we lack mindfulness, dogma can also be expressed as a lack of investigation or expressed as fixation or rigidity. Judgment, bias, also personal ideologies or even personal habits. Yeah? So if you'll go with me, I'm going to expand the term into more talking about these. So ultimately, whether we're receiving information from a scriptural or religious authority or any kind of authority for that matter, and then we take that as true without investigating it, I feel it's the same when we have our own individual judgments, habits, biases, and we don't investigate those, and we leave those as sort of, this is it. This is me. This is my experience. That's that person. They're like that. You see what I'm saying? So I believe that the feeling is not, it's the same. You see what I'm saying? Whether it's towards a religious or political affiliation or whatever, it's still a dogma. It's like this fixation and bind. So ultimately, when we fixate on something, we're bound. And by fixate, I mean we become stuck, obviously, right? We become kind of, you can see with just our sense perceptions, we can become stuck on something. Our emotions can become sort of fixated or stuck on, you know, both good and bad, both a feeling of maybe depression or a feeling of joy. And then we, you know, who doesn't want to feel that? So and then we want to hold it, so we kind of try to grab it, and then it's fixed. And right when that happens, it's bound. So for the most part, whatever causes us to contract, I'm just putting it out there. This is my feeling. This has been my experience. When a difficult emotion comes up for me, especially like something like anger, or just, you know, a strong aversion to something, automatically I contract instead of expanding. And when the contraction happens, immediately I feel stuck. You know, I feel not only fixed, bound, but I believe that that's the way it is, you know, especially with something like anger or aversion. Like today in the car, my sister drove me here, and my sister's great, and we get along. But when she gets off of work, she's really worked up, you know, like really, you know, pissed off. Like the un-PC way to say it. So, you know, it pisses me off all right away, because I'm like, you know, I don't want to be around that energy, and I want to just have fun, you know. So then the process is noticing that contraction and recognizing it, acknowledging it, and feeling it, which we're going to get to. But really, I think the first process is questioning, is leaving open this attitude of examination. And not, I don't mean examination like highly intellectual examination. I mean just from the mindfulness and awareness, being aware of what's going on and understanding to a certain extent on a feeling level, and being open enough that maybe I'm not right, you know? So ultimately, when we contract, there's also less space. There's sort of, there's a fixation, a bind. Things become more myopic. So then, how do we become aware of these biases? Because again, whether we're working with more of an intellectual dogma, more the traditional definition of dogma, or we're working with just our tendency to fixate, judge, be bound by our experience, what are the methods in Buddhism? So this is what I want to discuss now. So first, like I said, I think it's really important to just recognize our experience, to just recognize this is happening. So mindfulness is the first thing. Yeah, just some kind of awareness that this is happening, I'm experiencing this. And then again, if you're like me, it's easy to have like a judgment on top of a judgment. Have you ever experienced that? You know, where it's like, I'm judging someone else, then I notice I'm judging, and then I start judging my judgment. And there just is this, you know, like, ever see one of those hollow mirrors where it's just like a mirror, mirror, mirror? It's sort of like that, yeah? So I find it incredibly useful at those times when that's happening to just feel the feeling, yeah? So to simply just bring bare awareness to the feeling. Get out of the head as quickly as possible and just feel what that experience is, yeah? And then again, we have these practices of shamatha and vipassana, where they also bring us to so shamatha meaning Sanskrit for calm abiding, vipassana for special insight. I think most of you know these terms, but I'm just saying them just in case. So these are the sort of major two wings of how we liberate ourselves in Buddhism. And ultimately, shamatha includes these aspects of recognition, awareness, feeling to a certain extent, especially in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, feeling the feeling, feeling the sensation, whatever's happening, yeah? So with shamatha especially, we are really working with bringing the mind to a state of non-distraction. Also, we're bringing the mind to a state of, I don't like to use the term relaxation so much because I think that can be misunderstood, but yeah, a type of relaxation, calm abiding, where the mind can abide calmly on its object of meditation. So then with that non-distraction, it's very much like, you know, if you have a glass of muddy water and you just, if you shake it and you keep shaking it, you're just going to keep having a glass of muddy water. But if you let it sit for a certain amount of time, all the dirt goes down and then the limpid quality of that water comes out. So with shamatha, this is really the experience we're trying to cultivate, right? Now again, when that happens, again, what does that do? That gives us some amount of space to then penetrate into judgment and bias and these kinds of things. where we can start to have some distance from the experience and then the reaction, yeah, or the fixation on it. You guys look like you're falling asleep, so you know, okay, good. It's hard to tell sometimes up here, you know. Last night I was at a talk of my friends, was it last night? No, the night before, and I was just sitting there. You know, I'm not very expressive when I'm just sitting there, so I was like, oh yeah, this is how it looks from the other way. You know, like just, so I try to remember that, you know. But anyways, you feel free to chime in too. I'd like to, you know, we can have some discussion, so it's not just going one way. Yeah.
I had a question.
Yeah.
I like what you had to say about there's a couple things you touched on. But one thing that's been coming up for me recently in my adult life. Fixating on past mistakes or errors, or points in my life where I maybe had two choices and I took the wrong path or the wrong way, which ended up in a lot of unnecessary suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, for some reason, doing these life reviews lately, recently this year, a lot of life review where I would get stuck on those positions in my life where I'm thinking, if only I hadn't did this, or if I just done that a little differently. And being filled almost overwhelmingly with kind of regret or anger at myself or the situation or the other person that helped me make up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that, if that's uncommon or common or if it's really good.
Oh, I think it's really uncommon. I think you're I think you're totally screwed. No, I'm just joking. No, we all go through that, right? I mean, you know, even me, I'm probably, you know, close to half your age, maybe. So I go through that too. You know, I regret and get angry at myself for things I did in my teenage years and things like that. Or maybe last week, I guess. Yeah, I think it's really common. And, you know, again, this is where I think, like, practices of self-compassion are extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we can do a little guided meditation before we end tonight on sort of feeling the feeling and handshaking these kinds of things. Would that be cool with you? Does that sound good? Yeah.
I was just going to say, when you were talking about shamatha and vipassana, that you pronounce vipassana, that's the Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding of shamatha was very specific, I think, in Tibetan. I don't know if it's specific in all Mahayana Buddhist practice, but the word we might use is samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that has really a lot of different definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we may know it as one thing, but it also has lots of other definitions. It depends on who is using it, what tradition, and in what context. So I just wanted to kind of point that out so that if there's anything more specific you can say about that, that would be great.
Shamatha or samadhi?
Either. Well, both.
Samatha?
Samadhi. Are you not?
Yeah, I mean, samadhi usually, again, like you said, it's the same. Essentially, Theravada and Tibetan are not different because it's just, you know, we incorporate Theravada, so mm-hmm. it's all there, you know? It's just that the way they present it is a little different, but not much. Yeah, usually samadhi is used as more of like the result of, you know? It's more like the fruit. So you have the, you know, what we call the ground path and fruition.
Mm-hmm.
Samadhi is more like used as a term referring to the fruit of the practice, where shamatha is the path. Yeah, shamatha is sort of the path of what we practice. We practice calm abiding mm-hmm. to achieve a mind of non-distraction, mm-hmm. which is also a type of samadhi.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've also heard shamatha being translated as concentration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, that's.
And there are different kinds of concentration, different kinds of samadhi.
Yeah, so I can comment on that if you want. I mean, do you want, or did Did you just want to say it? Or?
I'm good. I'm just offering another definition that I had not heard.
Yeah. Yeah, specifically, I stay away from the word concentration because it has other connotations that Westerners put on Buddhism. Yeah. So it's actually, the term itself refers more to non-distraction, the actual literal Sanskrit and Pali. Yeah. But it's okay. I'm not saying it's, you're wrong or bad. It's just sometimes when we say single-pointedness, there's a sense implosion that can happen, meaning like people sometimes use this term laser-like concentration. Now, again, I'm not saying that's a wrong way to do it. It's just that that's a different result sometimes than if you're getting cultivating. Now, again, when we cultivate non-distraction, we'll get that, by the way.
Right.
Concentration will happen, right?
I just never even put that together. The non-distraction always seemed a little confusing to me. And concentration didn't, but I actually never put that together, but you're referring to the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I just started using that more. Sorry, Bruce. Because I used to use the word single-pointed concentration, and I had a good conversation with a monk friend of mine, and I felt he was correct and that the term non-distraction is more accurate. And it's also, when I'm practicing, it changed my practice. So, for instance, when I'm trying to practice single-pointed concentration, I don't know, for some reason it makes me really uptight. And I also feel like either I got it or I don't got it, And then when I think of more cultivating non-distraction, it again turns my attention more to putting the effort rather than focusing on the result. So we already have a culture of very much focusing on, we're very result-oriented. So I think using terminology and gaining experience that's more effort-oriented is a little more skillful for us. But, I don't know, maybe this comes anyways, regardless of the term, just as you practice over the years. I don't know.
What I thought I was hearing you put together, though, was that when we have an experience, and let's just say an example of a difficult emotion,
mm-hmm.
of fear,
mm-hmm.
That the capacity to be with it in a calm, abiding, or a non-distracted few moments or whatever period of time, that then allows you to be with it in a way that you can start to gain some wisdom from your experience.
Mm-hmm.
You can start to feel, okay, so what does this fear? What is my experience of fear? And you can actually hold, to some degree, whatever amount of time you have the capacity to do, your awareness on that difficult emotion, say, in the body.
Mm-hmm.
What is my experience of that in the body? And that's where the insight starts to come. That's the Vipassana insight aspect. And so that's what I thought I was hearing.
Yeah, I didn't really get there yet, but because I wanted to open it up a little bit.
No,
but it's good. I mean, yeah, what you're saying is, I was just going to do more on Vipassana and Shamatha, but no, it's good. It's a good segue. So then, I would say I'd agree. Yeah. I think that's sort of the way it works. There's also different types of Vipassana. So then depending on what style of Vipassana we're doing, but they ultimately it comes down to unifying these two. So the non-distraction that we cultivate then brings about over time. When we then apply insight or wisdom, we're able to actually penetrate into a deeper experience of that because we have the non-distraction or concentration, right? Yeah. Anyone else? I like discussing, so we could just do that too. I don't have actually much more to say too. But sure.
I appreciated your saying the way. We would use dogma to go beyond dogma.
Mm.
And there's so much of that in the scriptures. Once we look more carefully, there's even a sutta that has a list of things that you can use to go beyond. You use food to go beyond food. You use comparison with other people to go beyond conceit. The first step of the path is right view, but there's no view in the end that you can write down. So why is that right at the front of the path? Well, that's what we work with the dogmatic and the non-dogmatic.
Exactly.
You have to use view to go beyond view. If you don't have the right one, you won't go all the way beyond. It's the one that can undo itself.
Yeah.
So I'm appreciating the kind of the angle you came in from is one I hadn't considered before, but I, as you've talked more and more, I see it links up with a lot of stuff that I've been thinking about. So thank you for that.
Sure. No, thanks for bringing that up, because I kind of mentioned in the beginning, but I'll mention again, is like, it's always, I think this gets missed sometimes, because our culture, when we approach Buddhism, it's very meditative based, meaning like we want to just do meditation, because a lot of what we need right away is relief, like stress relief and calmness, because a lot of us don't have it, myself included. And so then sometimes what can, I'm just sort of going off of what you're saying, come out of that is it takes time to then get to like the view. Why are we doing that in the first place? What makes that a Buddhist practice? Because meditation itself, sitting there watching your breath, doesn't necessarily make it a Buddhist practice. It just doesn't. So what makes it a Buddhist practice is it's based on the view, which is this view essentially. Now again, this view changes in different sutras, and it changes as we progress the path. But it's sort of like a viewless view. I'll put it that way, yeah, like what you so eloquently said. So at the beginning, how we sit, like for instance, I love Dogen. Do any of you read Dogen? No, no Zen practitioners here.
Yeah.
There you go. He looks like a Dogen guy. So, anyways, I can't remember. I'm gonna totally butcher the Japanese. It's like do you know the Fuka, the Fukan Genzei? I
my favorite saying was like.
Uh-huh.
I love the way he describes it.
Do you remember this text though, the name of the Fukang, is it the Fukang Genzei or anyway?
Genjo-koan?
No, it's one of his famous texts on Zazen.
Close.
Yeah, I think I'm close enough. So this text, anyways, the whole like first part is very similar to one of our lamas in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition called Longchenpa, who is a famous lineage lama in the Nyingma tradition. The whole first part is like really ultimate view, you know? There is no this, there is no that, you know? Like, really ultimate, almost like it's saying, it's almost nihilist. It's very close to being nihilism. Then, it's not nihilism, though, but it's very close. Then, after that paragraph, then Dogen is like, but when you sit, you put your legs this way, you know, you sit straight, and you see what I'm saying? So, in Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, sometimes we come at it from that perspective, where we present the ultimate first and then go into the relative. But the way the Buddha generally presented in the Pali Canon is first relative, you know? So first you have sort of conduct. All these kinds of things are really important. Like for me, I like this example of offering incense. You know, especially in Zen tradition, you can see there's nice ritual around these things. You know, very beautiful and elegant with doing things. In Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we have like water bowl offerings. So when you make those offerings, it's very like ritualistic. And again, like that's fine, and we don't have a problem with that. But at the same time, at the end of the path, or at the beginning, if you want to put it there, it's saying, yeah, ultimately this is just, it's just a bowl of water, you know? And you can't find the water, you can't find the bowl, you can't find the person making the offering. But you're there. It's not nihilism. So this is what's very extremely profound about Buddhism. I didn't really mean to talk about emptiness tonight, but it's sort of coming out. Because I think when you have to talk about using dogma to eat dogma, or using dogma to go beyond dogma, we have to talk about this sort of way we work with relative and ultimate truth. So if it's too complicated, please ask questions. And I can, sometimes questions will pull it more out of me too. But why I'm saying this is because we tend to usually be hijacked into one or the other side. So either we get, mostly if you're like me, you get hijacked into the relative side, where I just believe everything I see, you know, or I feel. Oh, I'm angry. Okay, so I'm angry, you know. But some people do get hijacked into the ultimate side too much, meaning that they don't respect that, you know, this is an iPhone, and if you step on it, it will break, right? That's just relative truth, you know? That's just something that's there. So in this is what I find incredibly unique and profound and inspiring about Buddha Dharma, where, you know, there's this famous story also to represent this of like, you know, we have a boat, and you get in that boat to cross to the other shore. But once you get to the other shore, you don't need the boat anymore. right? You're done with the boat. There's no need to hang on to that. So it's a very similar process here. So, shamatha and vipassana. So, again, with this premise of working with judgment. Now, are we all good? I mean, do any of you need, like, why we'd want to work with judgment? You know, like, are we good there? Yeah? Okay. I figured. That's why I didn't go into it so much. And again, I prostrate to judgment. I don't judge judgment. Judgment is judgment. So we don't need to hate judgment either. But we can tell when we judge. I think all of you have this experience. We close down. We shut down. You know, we don't experience life as it is. Things become, instead of a fluid painting, they become, you know, just a photograph of something instead of just a moving art. I very much look at my perceptions these days as like someone painting. It's just this kind of painting. And I hope someday it can be like a painting on water. It's not quite like that for me yet. But eventually as we practice, it's like a painting on water. Things come, they're written, and then they dissolve as soon as they're written. Yeah? For someone like some of my teachers, it's like that. Yeah, you can pray for me. That'll be like that someday. I hope so. Not sure about this life, but we'll see. Keep practicing. So I hope it's like that for you too. Getting back to it. So then working with judgment through these practices of shamatha and vipassana, working with dogma through these. Obviously we talked a bit about settling the mind. All of you look like pretty really good shamatha practitioners actually. So the mind settles, and then this limpid quality of the mind we start to become aware of that. Meaning like just as a glass, if you could have just imagined that this was clear. You know, and not solid like it is. So if this was full of dirt and I let it sit, eventually you'd see the limpid nature or clear nature of the water, right? At that point, we can cross over into vipassana. So again, there's different ways to work with shamatha and vipassana. So I'm just presenting one from the Vajrayana tradition a little bit. So once we start examining, but examine is kind of the wrong word here. It's more like bringing awareness to the limpid quality of that water. Then the shamatha, which is the non-distraction, starts to meet with wisdom. And that wisdom, again, is an experience going beyond subject and object eventually, going beyond judgment. So in a very practical way, I find that personally when a really strong judgment comes up for me, often I use a question. So I'll use just sort of like, is this how it is? Or is this true? Or is this real? And I just sort of bring that question out. And then sometimes I just go from there to just the bare experience of it, either the feeling or the state of mind or perception, and bring shamatha to it. So bring form of concentration or non-distraction to whatever I'm working with, mindfulness, and then awareness, and then that awareness can cross over into noticing that we can't see any kind of like fixed thing there. Like, for instance, I judge people a lot. I have a very kind of busy thinking mind, so I tend to judge a lot. So then with a person, it's, you can just watch and you see, oh, there's the possibility for this, you know? Sometimes they do smile a bit. You know, sometimes if my judgment was negative of them, you know, there's some kind of, when I leave it bare, you start to see a bigger picture. So I call it sort of like more like a holistic way of working with things. And so, again, this is one very simple way to bring shamatha and vipassana in. Obviously, in the texts, and I hope you can tell I'm not speaking from a very, like, super traditional perspective tonight, because obviously there's practices that are in text where we can investigate from a philosophical point of view. I don't know how useful that is for us as Westerners. I think it is, but often we think so much already that I think first settling our mind and then letting kind of wisdom come out of that can be a helpful method for us at first. So sitting with that, then some kind of open quality. Even just a moment of, not the thought, maybe it's not like this, but the feeling, maybe it's not like this. then we start to have a flavor of non-judgment. Have you guys experienced this to a certain extent? Yeah, right? So again, going back to view, I'm sort of jumping around a little bit, but I wanted to go back to when I was talking about, for a Buddhist practitioner, it's really important to have the view, meaning we are aiming for liberation. That's the view. And what is liberation? Liberation is freedom from this or that, from subject and object, from any kind of fixed sense of self or fixed sense of phenomena. That's what liberation is in Buddhism. So with that sort of ground or view, meaning like that's our aim to a certain extent, and it's a goal, but it's sort of like a goalless goal is the way I think about it these days. With that as an aim, the practice sort of, again, I have to come at it from a dogmatic place saying, yes, do this, like this is what the Buddha said. But I don't really mean that, because it's within the experience itself, you can see it's like we can meditate and sit to do shamatha with just a motivation to feel good or to get some kind of calmness, but that's all we're going to get out of it. It will stop there, meaning like it will... we will eventually have some calmness, stress relief. We will feel better, but it won't go to liberation. Maybe it will eventually. I'm not going to say completely, because I think the practices of mindfulness and shamatha, they have this aspect of where once we have some space, maybe then we have like there's a spark that can come. But in general, in Buddhism, once we cultivate this aspect of working with shamatha and vipassana to hit at our bias. So that's essentially what I'm saying. Yeah. So if we've been meditating for years and you're like me, meditation hasn't really hit your bias very much, we have to reanalyze our motivation. We have to reanalyze our view. Why are we doing this? You know? And it's perfectly fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with stress relief. We all need that. We all need calmness. We all need to feel good. But at a certain point, after we've been practicing, we might want to reanalyze and upgrade that a little bit. So I'm advocating for that. There's no criticism or judgment, just advocating for that. So, and what am I advocating for? Upgrading to this attitude of what really binds us. So I've talked about it a lot, but just really reflecting on, you don't have to believe what I say. You don't have to read like a book, a Buddhist book, or read a sutra and believe what even the Buddha said. But really investigating what binds me, you know? So again, here, obviously I'm saying, you know, when we have some kind of fixation, we're bound. When we have a bias that comes up and we attach to that bias, then we bind our experience. And we don't have liberation in that moment. We have fixation and dualism, subject and object. So when we sit down to even practice shamatha with a motivation of seeking to go beyond our bias, to go beyond our judgment, or maybe a better way is to say to work with them, right? Maybe that's a little more practical. Then that meditation actually has the possibility of like a much more strength for that, because we're not just shooting aimlessly into the sky. We have our target and we're pointing our arrow directly at it. And then with that accuracy of shamatha, we're pointing the wisdom or view into hitting that target. Yeah. So I'm being a little bit vague about view, but I hope if I'm too vague, then you can pull it out through questions more and more.
So,
yeah.
I have a question.
I'm full of cables today.
So, if you're trying to use shamatha to counteract your natural bias,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about like accuracy, but then. Isn't like that bias gonna, you know, almost steer you away from aiming in the right direction? Like, or isn't
yeah.
that like the challenge?
That's a good question. I mean, yeah. I mean, you're right. I think we don't have a choice though, because like even sitting down to meditate is a bias, to a certain extent.
Meaning, if I take the bias and sort of, you know, bring it out more, where we have a bias, I don't want to meditate. You see what I'm saying? There's even a choice there. So almost we don't have a choice, so we just have to try to make our biases more positive, more like moving towards a constructive way of working with something. And then, I don't know if I'd call it a bias at that point, but it is a preference. But then eventually those preferences dissolve into the experience of meditation itself, where we experience a sense of spaciousness, of freedom. But keep going, because I think we can draw it out more. Because I don't think I answered your question, but...
But I think, as you were talking, I was reminded of what Kim was talking about. Something you said, like, the view that's able to unravel the right view, and so mm-hmm. it's kind of like you're maybe shooting in the dark for the direction, right? Or to where should you focus and what direction should you go? And you kind of are just like shooting in the dark.
Mm.
You might have some dogma to guide
exactly.
you
exactly, yeah,
in that direction. But there's still an element of sort of shooting in that dark. But then somehow in the process of doing it, you're able to unravel, or I don't know. That's kind of my understanding of everything.
Yeah, yeah. I think it depends what path you follow in Buddhism, because we have a lot of different paths. I don't mean traditions. I mean within traditions we have different paths. So, like for instance, we have a philosophical, more scholarly path. So at that point, the person becomes really, really like skilled at understanding what that target is. So they're not shooting in the dark from a thinking perspective, because they have a really clear understanding of the view of emptiness. What we're talking about is the view of emptiness. We're sort of aiming to shoot at that. So then, that kind of person, but they still don't know it directly. It's just a thinking, you know? So then they're shooting the arrow, but they're like, they're shooting in the kind of direction of the target, you know? Same in Mahamudra and Dzogchen. We shoot, and it's sort of very much like a blind person trying to hit this. No offense to any blind people. I'm in Santa Cruz. I got to be very PC. So it's sort of like a blind person or just closing your eyes trying to hit this. You know, you're going to sometimes miss, and then sometimes you'll hit it, you know? So, yeah, I think that's what you said is true. We are still in the dark a little bit, but through the process of dogma, it starts to turn the lights on more. So it's like instead of the target being there and we're shooting there, we're at least shooting in the right direction. You know what I mean? Is that clear?
I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you got it. And I think in a more experiential... Now again, there's more experiential styles or paths within Buddhism of shamatha and vipassana. Like the Mahamudra tradition is very much like this. Although it's informed by study. But you come to that wisdom through settling the mind and then essentially coming to an experience of that directly without a lot of thinking. Where some other paths, you use a lot of thinking, like analyzing, where can I find, you know, where is the iPhone? Is it here? Is it in the case? Is it in this button? Is it in that button? You know, and you analyze, where can I find that? Then it's like, the analogy is like rubbing two sticks together. So you're rubbing the analytical wisdom with the object of meditation until those two sticks catch on fire and everything dissolves. So there's different methods. I'm just saying this for your knowledge so you can understand a little bit. We have different styles. But yes, the way you said it, I think, would be closer to like a more experiential style, like where you're not using a lot of analytical investigation. Yeah, but it's good. Yeah. I think I confused Mark. Yeah.
Well, I started out in the Buddhist. Tibetan Buddhist path. Uh-huh. My introduction to meditation was a lot about visualization, and
yeah.
I'm not good at visualization, so it was really, it didn't work for me.
Yeah, I'm not good at it either.
Now I'm being more into the body focus, you know, the sensation, the body, the, you know, hearing, the senses. I have this, I talk about biases, and I keep kind of going back and forth between, well, if you're, because one of my Tibetan teachers said, if you're not focused on the Buddha, you know, it's all, you're just breathing, you know, something like that. So then here I'm over here focusing on my body and I'm wondering, am I just focusing on my body?
Yeah.
So it's all of it is like going through this uncharted territory that you've never been through before. So you're just trying to say, well, something happens and you go, well, is this this? Or is this nothing? You know? You know, I feel like I'm always a beginner because I've been trying to do this for a long time, and it's just so uncharted territory. It's like, when do you know that nothing is something? You know?
I think when you know it's nothing. Don't post. Yeah, that sounds like a cheesy Facebook thing, but it's true, actually. Yeah. So ultimately, I'm talking, you know, from the perspective of this ultimate certainty. But I think you're more talking about the practice of shamatha. So there, yeah, we have a lot of different ways we can use objects of, you know, we can have, when we have shamatha with support, with an object, then, yeah, it can vary. The Tibetan tradition, even they have different ones. You don't always have to visualize the Buddha. It's just sort of a method because it creates a virtuous habit while you're doing it, so they feel there's a little bit of an arrogance that it's better. I personally believe that it's fit to the person. Like, for instance, my teacher told me that objectless shamatha would be better for me to practice, which is shamatha without an object, where you just rest in the mind itself, the clarity of the mind. That becomes the object to remain non-distracted on. That really works for me. When I try to visualize, forget it. You know, it's the same as you. And then, of course, the body can be an object, the breath. Some people can stare at something, like staring at a stick or a rock or a statue of the Buddha. So definitely, these are all just different objects of meditation. And the point is to just choose one and just do it, you know, and stick with it for a while. And then as you gain what we call heat in practice, the heat is when each practice has a different heat. So the heat of shamatha is we're becoming more non-distracted, you know? And the mind starts to settle more and more and be able to abide more, you know, calmly. And again, as a result of that, there's more concentration. But as like a side effect. And then we can focus on the nature of something, the qualities of how it exists, and penetrate into that because we don't get distracted.
So the object of the meditation changes from the breath to the mind.
When you're talking about Vipassana? No, shamatha, you just have, like, you have your object, and then, you know, you can use the mind as an object of meditation. It's called the objectless shamatha. You can use your breath or the sensation of the body, statue, visualization, whatever. And then it doesn't change. It's just you, when it slips into Vipassana, there's a kind of an investigation that starts to happen.
I guess in my experience what happens is that, if I'm practicing, the breath just starts to happen on its own after a while, right? And then the attention goes to the you know, investigation of the phenomena.
I see, yeah. Yeah, then you would be in Vipassana, yeah.
So that's kind of a natural progression.
Yeah, I think like different traditions do it different ways. I think Theravada has a beautiful tradition of this, where it's a little bit more like that, where the shamatha and vipassana are unified more like that. In the Tibetan, like I said, we have scholarly ways where either the person gains stability in shamatha, not the dhyanas, the concentrations, but they have what's called the 9 stages of calm abiding. Then they'll use either analysis through thinking to penetrate into the nature of something, or we have practices like Dzogchen and Mahamudra, which more use where you're just trying to drop the concept right away. You're just trying to drop in a non-concept without any other method. So it's just depends on the method. Yeah. These are all different methods. And again, like I would say, there's no... You could order things by, like, in Buddhism, you can order them by skill, by how profound they are and how directly they access wisdom. But other than that, the profundity is how much it helps us. That's really where the profundity lies. if, for instance, like someone says working with the visualization of a statue for your shamatha practice is the most profound way to do it, but you can't do it, it's not profound for you. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. I'm thinking we could practice a little bit. He asked the question back there about, what do you call it? Aging with joy. How to age with joy, right? So maybe we'll just sit and do this practice. My teacher likes to call handshake practice. So this isn't really a practice of shamatha or vipassana, so I apologize. But it's definitely a way to work with judgment, for sure. Yeah, and to work with dogma. So we could just sit and just first recognize your body. Feel your body being ground into the earth. Feel your legs on the ground or your feet connected to your upper body. Just spend a second with that. So then gently, with awareness, just notice whatever is most present in your experience right now. Sensation's fine, but well, what I'm talking about is a quality of a feeling or energy. But anything's okay, whatever's most present. It could be maybe boredom, maybe you're tired, maybe you're joyful, maybe even blissful. Maybe you have anxiety. Maybe you're just really relaxed and calm. Whatever that is, just gently bring your awareness to that, whether it's a painful feeling or a neutral feeling or a pleasant feeling. So the awareness is not like a heavy thing we're bringing to change the experience, especially if it's a painful one, because usually our tendency is to want to change it. We're just bringing the recognition and acknowledgement of that experience. So the handshake is a little bit like an acknowledgement, just gently touching that experience. And once we've touched it with a very gentle touch, especially if it's a painful feeling, just be with that, rest with that. You're not fixating on it as an object of meditation. You're just merely touching it and letting it do what it does. If it wants to shift, let it shift. But don't shift it yourself. Here we're just letting it be, whatever that experience is, whatever we've noticed. But we're letting it be with awareness. So we have awareness of it. But the awareness isn't becoming so involved in it. So really there's nothing special we're bringing to this. There's no shamatha. There's no vipassana. There's just this bare awareness, touching and handshaking this experience we're feeling. Or energy. We're not trying to name it or recognize it or analyze it, change it, manipulate. Just let it be. So if we're if a regret or guilt comes up, this is also something to handshake. This becomes a teacher to us, where when we handshake and give it space, we can learn what it has to say, even if it's appearing like a monster. That's what my teacher calls a beautiful monster. Because as we sit with that monster of guilt or anger, anxiety, whatever it is, if we just let it express itself, while also giving us the freedom that we don't get hijacked by it, eventually the monster might tell us something. It might tell us. It might open. Because these beautiful monsters also want to open, just as we want to work with them and be free of a painful experience. They also want that. They also want to be free. But when we push them and manipulate them and suppress them and try to move them around and move them here and there, we're not giving them freedom to open. We're just trying to box them in. So here this is a practice of complete non-judgment. Managed to touch one of these beautiful monsters, I congratulate you. And I invite you to continue to work with it. Eventually, as they open more and more, and the layers peel, they become allies. We can start to have an experience of what my teacher calls essence love, which is just a basic sense of okayness, well-being, a sense that we're okay, who we are. So that's a little taste of handshake practice, and if you'd like more, I invite you to come to our retreat in Los Gatos. Not to be a salesman, but Sogyal Rinpoche will be teaching on that for at least 2 or 3 days in May here in Los Gatos, or one of his other retreats you can come to. And it's I find that practice to be one of the most helpful things. So sometimes I'm not doing shamatha or vipassana, I'm just doing that. It's a type of vipassana a little bit, so it's kind of a sneaky going into the back door of vipassana. But it's an incredibly rich practice, because you're not manipulating or trying to shift anything. You're just being with the experience. Or often, if you're like me, I'm always trying to like fix something. You know, so this practice is one of my, it's probably one of my main practices. So maybe again, I can come back and we can do more of that. We can do just some a talk on that one if you guys want. People usually like that. I've done it here before. We did some, yeah. So just want to thank you guys. Really enjoyed tonight, and yeah, maybe we could just dedicate some of the virtue we created together by meditating and discussing eating dogma, eating dogma, and just reflecting on this together. So we'll just dedicate it to, you know, the world needs liberated people. And the reason is not so we can feel we're liberated. The reason is so we can help others to see that that liberation is in their heart as well. So we're just going to dedicate all the energy from tonight to that. So nam de tam che ze ban ni ton ne ni pe ra nam tam che ni ke ga na che ba lan chu ba yi si pe so le jo wa ra jo wa ra sho jang shu san cha ren bon shi ma ke ba nam ge ge chi ke ba nam ba nam ko ne go do pa wa ra sho ton ne ta wa ren bon shi ma ke ba nam ge chi ke ba nam ba me ba yang go ne go do pa wa ra sho Thanks so much. And thanks, Joel and Bruce, for having me again.
Yeah.
I wish all you guys luck. May we be enlightened in the same mandala, is a phrase I really like to say. So it's a traditional prayer. But, you know, we're all connected, and may we remain connected and keep helping each other along the path. Yeah? Yeah. Thanks.